Welcome to Cross-Examining Cyber, a podcast brought to you by Herbert Smith Freehills. In this podcast series, we explore all things cyber, including the legal, regulatory, and policy developments that impact corporates around the world. We look at the evolving cyber risk landscape by speaking to those people who are on the front line, protecting companies from cyber incidents and shaping the legal and regulatory environment. I'm Cam Whitfield, a partner at Herbert Smith Freehills and leader of our Asia-Pac cyber practice. In this episode, we cross-examine Andy Penn. Andy really needs no introduction. An extensive career at the top of corporate Australia, including as CEO for Telstra, and he recently took on the role of chair of the Expert Advisory Panel, advising the government on the cybersecurity strategy. Andy is as insightful as he is thoughtful, and it's clear that he has thought deeply about the cyber issues confronting Australia. Thanks again for joining us. Andy, welcome to the podcast. Where does this podcast find you today?
Hi, Cam. Well, it's great to be joining you. I'm actually joining you from my home in Mexico, in a town just north of Mexico City called San Miguel de Allende, where I have a home and spend a little bit of time every year.
Very lucky. And what's the weather doing over in your place at the moment?
You probably don't want to hear. San Miguel has 330 days of sun per year, and it's currently coming into summer because it's sort of in the northern hemisphere, but it's at 2,000 metres above sea level. So it's sort of average high at 30 during the day and 15 in the evening, and very sunny. It's very pleasant.
That sounds terrible. We're based in Melbourne, and we may well get that temperature today, but we may also get 5 degrees and sleet. So... Andy, before we start to jump into the nitty-gritty around cyber, we know you well here in Australia from your many years leading Telstra, of course, but you have a history that extends further back than Telstra, and you've got certain roles that you're playing now. I'd love to hear a little bit more about your journey, and perhaps the journey that led you to Telstra, and then where you see yourself now, having stepped back from sort of executive management and moving into roles which I'm sure and appear to have significant relevance.
No, well, thanks, Kim. Well, why don't I start where your question finished, which is, you know, what am I doing now, I guess, in the transition? And the first thing I would say is that I think I learned in life that you need to step down from a position when you're not quite ready and when people still want you to stay. And I turned 60 about a year ago when I was stepping down from Telstra, and I loved my role. I really did. I was very passionate about the company, passionate about the role, but I needed to look forward to the future and what else I might do. And I wanted to start that journey when I was still young enough and had enough energy to make an impact, to make a difference. And I felt that Telstra was in, you know, a good position. And, you know, I think like all of us, nothing was perfect, but I felt as if under my leadership, you know, the company was in a better place and was well positioned for the future. And it's interesting as I go on this transitional journey, one of the things that Telstra gave me the opportunity to do was to be involved in a number of things in the policy landscape, just by virtue of the nature of a company which obviously provides an essential service to all Australians, but also is part of critical infrastructure in the company, in the country. And then, of course, also because, you know, a telecommunications company sits at the heart of all digital communications, and the topic obviously we're going to come on to today, cybersecurity. So it was through that role drew me into the policy landscape on cybersecurity and critical tech, and I've been continuing to make a contribution of work in that space post my Telstra life. So it's a transition that I'm enjoying. I miss my days as a full-time executive. I miss my days at Telstra, which is not the same as saying that I want to go back and change my mind. Yes. I'm happy with what I'm doing now too.
It's an interesting thing to sort of step back from that role where your relevance is so acute to a position where perhaps it's more generalised. So, yeah.
It is, Cam. And, but, look, you know, you have to step into that knowingly, and you want to control that journey because that's the way it's going to be. Yeah, because you're running in these roles for a finite period of time, and you have a particular position, and you know a lot of things that go with that. But I think always being a step ahead of it, always being, you know, taking the lead and steering the direction is, I think, important. Certainly, it's been important for me.
Yeah, and a great example of that is the role that you've picked up on the Expert Advisory Board, probably the most significant role in formation of that strategy. Can you help us understand, and you chaired that group, what that process was like. It was a lengthy process. I know you went through extensive consultation. I attended many meetings where you were taking the time with different stakeholders. Can I understand a little bit more about how that evolved and how that sort of 10, 11, 12 month period sort of worked for you as you sort of flushed out all the most significant aspects of our cybersecurity sort of policy settings?
Yeah, no, sure. Well, I think the first thing to say is I came to it with a little bit of background in the policy sort of side of cybersecurity. I mean, I obviously had a industry perspective and a commercial perspective on cybersecurity, and of course also working with government, because in the end, you know, in a government policy landscape, from that perspective, you can't do anything without engaging with the local telcos. That is where all of the digital activity essentially occurs. And in fact, I remember distinctly the first meeting I had at a policy level on cybersecurity was back in 2015 when Tony Abbott was the Prime Minister. And I remember having a meeting in Sydney with a bunch of different people and advisors. And it was when the government was then developing its 2016 strategy. And then subsequent to that, I was asked by Peter Dutton to lead the expert advisory board on the development of the government's, which was then the coalition government's 2020 cybersecurity strategy. I was then asked to chair the expert advisory panel, industry advisory panel that helped them in relation to the implementation of that. And then when we had the new government, I was asked to head up the expert advisory board for the development of the new 2023 strategy. The reason I give you that history is that, I'll try and keep out of any type of political aspect of all of this, but the one thing I think the one thing that demonstrated was that, you know, there is a relatively bipartisan perspective and approach to national security and cyber security. And it's sort of relatively unusual to have, you know, a third party or an independent person such as myself be appointed by both sides of government on something that's a pretty important policy point. And I think that's a good thing, not that it was me necessarily, but it was a good thing in the sense that it does support that bipartisan approach. But anyway, I was asked by the minister if I would lead the expert advisory board, and essentially it was not to provide a independent expert advisory report as such. It was actually to help and work with Department of Home Affairs, Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, and with government generally. And in conjunction with also, I had the support of a global panel, which was chaired by Kieran Martin, the former head of the National Cybersecurity Centre in the UK, and then also Mike Rogers, former head of Cyber Command in the US. And so we had some really heavy lifting and, you know, very significant support, really helped me lead an expert advisory panel, which was working alongside the Department of Home and Affairs and government in the development of the strategy and providing input on the policy. And that, as you say, was for a period of about 10 or 11 months and reasonably intensive, given I had sort of stepped down for as a full-time executive position. I wouldn't have said it was full-time, but it was, you know, close to 40% of my time on that.
Yeah, and I'm sure you spent a bit of time on a plane too, going back and forth. It's comforting to hear, Andy, that you're experiencing this bipartisan support around this. I mean, if that wasn't the case, and, you know, there's always the temptation to politicise certain components of these sort of things. I guess that's the beauty of our democracy. But to see or hear that bipartisan support, I think, is of significant relief for those that operate within those policy settings. Can I change tack slightly? Because as a practitioner, I spend a lot of time speaking with corporates across Australia around what I call the different types of threats, the threat landscape we're leaning into. You've had a chance to speak and to many who have been impacted by these events, but also I suspect you've had an inside running as well as a leader of an organisation cognizant of those threats and how to keep those threats at bay. What are you seeing in that space, or what are you hearing in that space? And are there any sort of nuances we need to be aware of? And I say this in the context of understanding that we still have state-based threats, we still have criminally motivated, we still have potential insider sabotage type events and those that are sort of ideologically or activist-minded. But what are you seeing and hearing in this space?
Look, I think a few thoughts, Cam. I think the first is that success can't be defined as eliminating the digital threat. It has to be defined by learning to live with it. You know, we've lived in the physical world pre sort of the level of technology that we have at our disposal today. We've lived in the physical world for centuries and, you know, even in advanced economies in the last sort of decades. And we've not managed to eliminate criminal activity or malicious activity in the physical world, unfortunately, there's still espionage, there's still terrorism, there is still crime, there is still petty crime, violence, those things. But we have learned to live with it in the physical world. It's not surprising, is it, that as we have increasingly taken more of what we do in the physical world online, such as their banking and shopping and all types of other activities, that the criminals and malicious actors have followed us there. It's hardly surprising when you think of it like that. And so, therefore, you know, and particularly obviously COVID gave up a great boost to the level of digital activity and what we've been doing online and studying online and working online, all these sort of things. And so, of course, the level of malicious activity has increased. I think the complication with cybersecurity as distinct, I suppose, from living in the physical world is a couple of dimensions. I think the first dimension is that the protagonists can, you know, be located almost anywhere in the world and often in jurisdictions which won't necessarily pursue, you know, even if we were able to identify who the malicious actor is, actually prosecuting them. And so therefore creating any type of disincentive is much more challenging in the cyber world. And I think the second thing, which is relevant to cybersecurity in particular, is that the harm that is caused and the people that are impacted are not necessarily those that the ones which were necessarily the target in the first instance from the malicious actor. And so therefore, you can have a malicious actor that may be motivated by, for example, a nation state objective that creates a vulnerability that becomes known that then cyber criminals identify and then seek to exploit. And so therefore, the threat between, you know, where the malicious activity started and then where the damage was done is not necessarily a consistent one. So therefore, to some extent, I see as a digital user, whether it's a company or as an individual, to some extent, where the malicious activity originated is slightly sort of irrelevant. Actually, what's most relevant is how do we protect ourselves online? And if you look at some of the big cases, obviously, that occurred in Australia in the last couple of years, like, for example, the Medibank case, where you've had, you know, a cyber incident, you've had a massive exfiltration of, you know, highly sensitive personal data, you've had a ransom claim, and, you know, without the payment of that ransom, the protagonist sort of threatened to and did, as I best understand, I don't have any inside information on this, as best I understand, then sort of publish some of that information on the dark web. How that thing gets used to cause harm was really sort of, is not actually the coming from the original ransom or the original protagonist. And so, you know, you've got to think about it in a much more complex sort of dynamic. And I think we'll come on to some of the sort of the interventions that we can take, I guess, to address that. But that's one of the distinctions that I see with cybersecurity. But I come back to where I sort of started by answering this question is, therefore, we can't see success, or rather, I think we will fail as if we see success as eliminating the digital threat completely. We've got to learn to live with it, such as we learn to live with malicious activity in the physical world, and how we can protect ourselves and make ourselves feel safe. And I'm not sort of being, I suppose, fatalistic in that regard. It's just that I do sort of sometimes worry a little bit that, you know, a lot of the strategic thinking is, oh, you know, well, cybersecurity is, your cyber, malicious cyber activity is a bad thing. Therefore, we've got to guarantee that none of it can get through. Unfortunately, some of it is going to get through.
Yes. And particularly with the geopolitics that we're experiencing at the moment, it doesn't feel like, to be frank, within the medium term or even the long term, that we're going to find ourselves in a situation where certain individuals aren't operating in jurisdictions which aren't particularly interested in prosecuting or following through on those sort of threats.
Well, they never have been necessarily. It's just that because the level of malicious activity has been enabled digitally, it just means that people physically don't need to be in our jurisdiction to inflict malicious activity, and therefore it's harder to create the disincentive and it's harder to prosecute and chase down those criminals or those malicious actors and get prosecutions.
Do you mind if I jump forward just a little bit? Because you've introduced a really interesting component here, which is the success of what I'd call law enforcement in this space. Because at the end of the day, and we have seen some recent successes, the takedown of certain threat actor web leak sites, disruption of Black Cat Lock and the like, How have you seen the evolution of sort of the efficacy of that law enforcement component? I suspect they're maturing like all of us, getting to learn this and getting better and better. But they are an important component of our both offensive and defensive security.
No, look, that's absolutely right. And I think you put your finger on it, Cam, that they're going through an evolution and a learning process as much as we all are. And again, you know, if you step back and think about it, just not limited to cyber, but just like, you know, more broadly, in the context of Australia, you've got those agencies that are very focused on national security and nation state, you know, considerations such as the Australian Signals Directorate or ASIO, and then, you know, and then bringing that to sort of the bridge between, I suppose, that and more national sort of security. You know, we've got the Australian Federal Police, and then of course each state's got its own police agencies, and then you've got the special agencies such as the Australian Criminal Investigation Commission, and you know, there are a whole bunch of agencies doing really good work to protect our national and local security, and they all have a role to play, and at every dimension, malicious actors that they've historically been dealing with are developing digital skills to be able to conduct their tradecraft and their malicious activity against us with the benefit of digital interactions. On the flip side, obviously, we're able to also use digital technology and new methods and new capabilities to try and defend against that and to try and improve our, our efforts to, you know, stopping that and to, you know, targeting it and discovering it and creating prosecutions. And so I've worked with all of those agencies in, you know, both in my former role at Telstra, but also for some of the policy work that I've done. And, you know, and they're all facing many of the same sort of issues that yes. You might be as a corporate. The reality is, as I started this podcast, is that the world has become increasingly digital and there's great benefits from that, but it's not surprising, is it?
Yeah.
But the malicious actors that did us harm in the physical world are taking advantage of that to do us harm in the digital world. And we've all, including all of the security agencies and the policing agencies, have to build their capability, which is what they're all investing in.
Yeah, and whether it's digital or physical, a crime is a crime is a crime, right? So you've got to actually sort of start thinking about this.
And Cam, you know, often there isn't a delineation between it either.
Yes.
I spoke at a event with some a sort of a joint policing group a while ago, and I sort of made the point that I can't imagine that there's a physical crime that doesn't have some digital component to it. In other words, whether that's either the crime has somehow been perpetrated with support, you know, whether the criminal has used, you know, a mobile phone or some other, or the actual solving of the crime can enlist some digital support as well. And so, you know, our worlds have become very converged, and we all need to build the digital skills to be able to cope with that.
That's a fantastic segue into a conversation around what I'd call the journey that corporate Australia, the execs of corporate Australia and the board, the directors and boardrooms in corporate Australia are dealing with at the moment, upskilling, arguably becoming more skillful by the day as we lean into more and more of these incidents. But how, when we look back, I doubt many executives went through the Harvard Business School 6-month course on how to negotiate with a criminal threat actor or what to expect in this sort of space. How are we, do you think we are on our sort of journey to sort of uplift that skill level at that executive level and board level to understand how to grapple with this issue?
Look, I think we're on a journey and, you know, we've clearly got a way to go, and that's not meant to be a criticism, but, you know, I think that this digital threat, the threat of cybersecurity, has really sort of escalated upon us. And I do think, as I said, COVID was a significant factor in all of that, just because of the rate of digital adoption, working online, shopping online, consuming online, whatever we were doing, suddenly lifted up the level of digital adoption much faster than might have otherwise occurred, and that created an opportunity. And And so we're finding ourselves, you know, rapidly having to build us, you know, capabilities in this regard. One of the things that I observe at the sort of senior management level, at the government policy level, at the board level, is that, you know, we have some very, very good technical expertise in companies around the country, in government, in the cybersecurity space, and really competent and skilled CISOs. But I think they find it difficult to communicate or articulate the challenge, or rather what organizations need to do, in a language that, that people can access and feel comfortable with making the right decisions. And then on the flip side, you know, you've got, I think, people are in very senior positions who need to make some of the policy decisions and strategic decisions and governance decisions necessary in relation to cybersecurity, don't have the level of, I guess, in-depth expertise or familiarity with the topic to have the confidence to know how to. And so we've got to find ways to bridge that gap.
Yep.
And I think that, you know, to me, cybersecurity is not really unlike any other risk. The name of the game is, as a, you know, for example, as a non-executive director, you know, the question in my mind is, how do you know that you've taken all reasonable steps to both mitigate against the cybersecurity incident and then have in place the response actions and response plans in the event that one occurs? How do you get to the end of a board discussion and a governance discussion to give yourself comfort in that regard? And I think the bottom line is most boards are not quite there yet. Not because they're not working hard and they're trying hard, but I think if you ask most boards and also other sort of governance bodies, most of them would still sort of come away with a level of unease on the cybersecurity risk topic, where they might not in relation to other risks that the company might face. And that's the reality, is it's a, again, as I said at the beginning, I think trying to guarantee you're never going to be the victim of a cybersecurity incident is probably unrealistic. Doesn't mean to say it will happen, but I think if that's your vision of success, then, you know, I think you're going to be challenged. But knowing that you've taken every reasonable possible step, given the circumstances and given the risk and given the context, and also that you've got in place a response plan in the event something does happen, is really where we want to get ourselves to.
You make such a fantastic point around the language of cyber, because it's not something that's spoken about often, really, that there might be a disconnect between the way in which our CISOs speak and the way in which our boards and management speak, and whether or not there's an understanding. I've certainly been in meetings, Andy, where I've seen CISOs, and I mean this with all due respect, give briefings to boards. Boards ask questions of CISOs and the like, and I know they've left the room not fully understanding one another. And every now and then it's incumbent on me or the role that I'm playing to make sure that there is that understanding. So you put your finger on this intangible but such a critical component of our sort of governance. Do we actually understand each other when we talk about this problem?
So here's my three-step, I suppose, framework that I think about in relation to this, maybe putting myself in the shoes of a non-executive director or a senior manager of a company. I mean, the first is, I would say, it's not possible to protect something that you don't know that you have. So say that again. It's not possible to protect something that you don't know that you have. So therefore, the first thing you must do, or one thing that you must do, is you must have a very comprehensive inventory of your digital assets. And by your digital assets, I mean your systems, your endpoints, your data sets, your encryption keys. And that sounds simple, but in large complex companies, particularly companies like Telstra, where obviously I was working, you know, there's a lot in that. And you would be surprised how many organizations, not just companies, but government agencies and not-for-profit organizations, do not have a comprehensive inventory of all of their digital assets. So that's the first point I would say. I think the second point I would say is that the greatest threat to your digital safety is not the bad actors, it's how you engage online. So I'd say the greatest threat is not the digital actors, it's how you engage online. By that, what I mean is that if I've got that inventory of my digital assets, I now need to understand how they are protected and who is protecting them and the level of security that it's appropriate to put around them. And you can use, there's all sorts of models that you can use to do that. The Essential 8 is very obviously one we use here in Australia. NIST produces some, which is US organization. There's something called the Five Nodes of Data. I'll come back to encryption keys. Don't let me forget that one because I wouldn't mind touching on that because I think that's an area that's it's sort of been under considered to date. But my simple point is I've now got my inventory of digital assets. Not all assets are the same, a bit like my personal assets. I worry slightly more about my bank accounts than I do about my Netflix account. And so given that sort of context, I want to know what's the appropriate framework for protecting them and how are they currently protected and where are the gaps? And then I need an implementation plan to basically close those gaps and be able to keep a line of sight on it. And then the final pillar in my sort of three-part sort of process or framework is the worst time to develop a response plan is in the middle of a crisis. So don't wait to have a crisis to develop your response plan. And by the response plan, I mean how you're going to cauterize the issue, what are all your stakeholder communications, what's the process for recovery and remediation, what simulations have you done? So if I'm a board member and I feel that I've got a thorough and comprehensive inventory of all of my digital assets, I know the frameworks by which I'm protecting each of them, and I know how well I'm doing that because there will absolutely be gaps. Yes. And then I've got an implementation plan in place to close those gaps. And thirdly, in the meantime, I've got a comprehensive response and recovery plan. I think I can feel that, you know, I'm taking pretty reasonable steps in relation to this risk. And I think if we can put it into that sort of language, and then, of course, I can get expert independent advice. Sure. I can get organisations such as yours or other organisations to come in and say, you know, how much integrity does have my inventory of digital assets have? You know, am I assessing properly, you know, the risks in relation to each of them? Have I really closed the gaps? Am I using the right frame? You then sort of start to get a grounded sort of set of parameters around this problem that as a director you can hang on to and, you know, help navigate a company. Sorry, not just as a director, also as a senior executive and a senior member of senior management.
There's something to be said, isn't there, about reducing the attack surface? And that's a sort of a clear and obvious way, a non-negotiable, if you like. And I remember going all the way back to the five no's, actually, understanding like your data holdings, your protection, all that sort of stuff. So these principles that we're talking about are not new. They've been around for a while. I think it's sometimes it takes a little while to trickle through, I guess. Thanks again for tuning in to Cross-Examining Cyber, a podcast brought to you by Herbert Smith Freehills. In our next episode, we continue our cross-examination of Andy Penn. The conversation continues, so don't forget to tune in. Thank you, Andy, and thank you all for listening.